7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with Kennesaw State University sociology professor Melvin Fine. He's written the book Post-Liberalism, The End of a Dream, Countless Promises That Liberalism Has Made and Why None of Them Have Come True. And he joins us from Canton, Georgia. Welcome to you, Professor.
I'm happy to be here.
Welcome. Glad welcome, Professor. Before we look at how liberalism is dying, I thought we'd first define it. Could you please give us a definition of liberalism?
Well, you know there are many, many definitions, okay? But nowadays, liberalism is a kind of government-centered philosophy that believes the government has a duty to help people in this world. In particular, there's a duty to equalize a very unequal kind of world and to bring about what they would call social justice. That, in a nutshell, I think is what most liberals believe.
In your book, you say that liberalism is a fantasy of the young. I understand that, but explain it a little further.
Well, you know, it's sort of like when you're young, you tend to be idealistic. You certainly know the things that are wrong with the world. There are certainly many, many things. But you don't yet know why things go wrong the way they do. And so you have dreams, and the dreams sound good, and they sound like they're doable. But in the process of living, you learn that, wait a minute now, not everything that sounds good is good or even possible.
You know, in the title of your book, you say countless promises that liberalism has made and none of them have come true. Were not the civil rights movement and the women's movement, among others, outgrowths of liberalism? And wouldn't you say they were successful?
Well, civil rights certainly has been largely successful. But you've got to remember, you know, when civil rights was passed, it was passed with an awful lot of Republican votes. It goes back to, you know, Abraham Lincoln, God bless, a Republican. So the notion that civil rights is exclusively a liberal concern, I think, is mistaken. As for feminism and feminist things, I think that, wait a minute now, to the degree that women have attained a better place in the world in recent years has very little to do with what liberals have done. So often, programs intended to do good have not done what they said, and progress has been made, but for other reasons.
And what other reasons are you attributing the progress to?
Well, one of my books, incidentally, is called The Great Middle Class Revolution. We are the first primarily middle class society in the history of the world. We are pioneers in this development, and it has changed our social relationships up and down the line. We are a different kind of people because, the way I would describe it, more and more of us have become professionalized. We have become self-motivated experts in what we do, and we have the resources, the riches, to live in life far different than that of our ancestors. It's these changes that have made the difference, not a lot of the political programs.
But the middle class is all but disappearing right now. Isn't that a...
That is certainly absolutely flat-out untrue. I remember when Kerry was running for president, and they were talking about the declining middle class, and the evidence at that time, not now, at that time, was that, yes, the middle class, as defined by the feds, was shrinking because the upper classes were increasing, not as implied because more people were getting poor. Now, thanks to the recession, yes, more people are poorer than they were. But even poor people today live in a way far in excess of what their ancestors did. No, we are a middle-class society with middle-class standards, with the middle class setting the standards for everyone, including the rich.
Professor Melvin Fine, could you elaborate on the social domain theory that you talk about in the book?
Sure. In other words, what I'm saying is, if you're going to understand human societies, you've got to understand how incredibly complicated they are. In sociology, we have long distinguished between social cultures and social structures. Social cultures are kinds of the ways in which we live, the rules that we live by, our morality, our belief systems, our rituals, things like that. Whereas social structures include things like our personal relationships, our hierarchical relationships, social exchange, and in terms of where we're going in society, our social roles. Those are becoming far more important nowadays. And if you're going to understand the world, you've got to understand all of these things. Lots of folks on the left, in particular the Marxists, and I understand that not all liberals are Marxists, but the Marxists see this world in hierarchical terms, where you've got the elites, the capitalists, oppressing the proletarians, and that's the whole picture so far as they see it. It's not the whole picture. It's a much more complicated picture.
Did you just say that not all liberals are Marxist?
I did say that. That is true, isn't it?
I guess that would be then that Franklin Roosevelt and LBJ were Marxists?
Well, now, Franklin Roosevelt, God bless him, he was not much of anything. But his brain trust was certainly tilted in the Marxist direction. There's no question about that. As for LBJ, well, LBJ was a pragmatist. LBJ just wanted to get things done, although the things he wanted to get done were very much on the liberal spectrum, many of which were inspired, yes, by Marxists.
Can you tell us how? Can you be more specific?
Well, now look. Part of what LBJ wanted, remember, LBJ was going to give us the war on poverty. He was going to eliminate poverty. This is a liberal objective. One of the goals of the Marxists is the world in which everyone is going to be completely equal. We are not going to have any more stratification. Well, the war on poverty aimed to move us in that direction, where, yes, there could be no more poor people in this world. I mean, the Bible may have said the poor will always be with us, but LBJ and the Marxists say, no, 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 no. We're going to get to a point where that never happens again, at least not in the United States.
You know, you say that liberalism requires universal love. What do you mean by that? Doesn't it just seek universal respect and equality for others?
Oh, no, no. I think it's much more than that. Personally, I believe very much in universal respect. But I also believe that some people, see, there's some respect that we deserve just for being human beings. We all
right.
deserve to be treated decently. On the other hand, some people achieve things in this world and some people don't. And the people who achieve things deserve to be respected for that to a greater degree. I don't believe in this business of unconditional positive regard or, God forbid, not judgmentalism. Those are rubbish, worse than rubbish. They're crazy.
Analyze President Barack Obama and his form of liberalism, in your view.
Well, Barack Obama seems to know almost nothing about economics. He certainly wants to take from the rich and give to the poor, and that's going to... He calls that an investment. It's nothing of the sort. It's a transfer payment, for heaven's sakes. Going to keep us in the recession for many years more, just like Roosevelt kept us in the Depression for two full terms. Obama's going to keep us in this mild recession for two full terms, God bless him, because he does not seem to understand what's necessary to make the economy work, nor does he seem to want to.
What does he not understand? What, in your view, would make the economy work that he's not understanding?
People have to make money. There's no reason why people are going to start businesses or invest in businesses if they're not going to be able to be successful. You know, one of the things that Roosevelt did in the early part of his term is raise the rates, the income tax rates, on the rich to astronomical levels, in the 90th percentile range. Okay? He thought, well, we're going to get lots more money. Wrong. The amount of money that they collected from the rich people was cut in half. Why? Because they weren't investing. There was no point in investing and making money.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, we're speaking with Kennesaw State University sociology professor Melvin Fine. He's the author of Post-Liberalism, The End of a Dream.
The Death of a Dream. The Death of a Dream.
Okay, The Death of a Dream. Our telephone number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLR. And I apologize for that, Professor.
That's okay.
You know, you wrote this book before the president was reelected. Does his reelection contradict any of your views?
You know, I didn't expect him to be reelected. I thought that the amount of pain that he had caused the country would be sufficient to see him a one-term president. Didn't happen. But the amount of pain that he's going to cause during the second term, that I think is going to persuade people that, wait a minute now, hopes and dreams, well, maybe it wasn't going to work out. Maybe it couldn't work out. You know, the president paints these lovely word pictures, but, you know, where's the beef, as they said during the Mondale campaign? Where's the beef? Where have been the improvements? I don't see them so far. I see lots and lots of promises. I don't see a lot being delivered upon.
We're speaking with Professor Melvin Fine. He's written Post-Liberalism, The Death of a Dream, and it's on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break. Professor, please stay with us, and we'll be right back and take some calls.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with sociology professor Melvin Fine of Kennesaw State University. He's written the book, The Death of a Dream, Countless Promises That Liberalism Has Made and Why None of Them Have Come True. Also, I forgot to give out our email address. That's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
Professor, how does a liberal differ from a progressive, or do they?
They don't. It's simply the terms change depending upon the political needs. It's the same folks believing the same things. It's just what progressivism implies is that liberalism is automatically going to bring improvements. I mean, this is a kind of word magic. You know, it's the assumption is that conservatives are really conservative, that they don't want change, whereas that's not true either. You know, it's more a matter of government liberals wanting a centralized system in which they take care of people, and conservatives wanting a decentralized system in which people are allowed to take care of themselves. That's the main difference.
Professor, in your book, you talk about constrained versus unconstrained visions of humanity. Could you elaborate on that?
I absolutely can. You know, it's sort of like, lots of times liberals believe that if you can dream it, you can do it, that anything is possible, that we human beings are totally plastic, that if they have a dream, that they can automatically make it come true. That's the unconstrained view. The constrained group's view says, no, no, no. We human beings have limitations. We're selfish. We are ignorant about many things. There are lots of limitations on what we have. One of them, for example, is this. We human beings are a hierarchical species. We automatically rank one another. It isn't a matter of, oh, gee, hierarchies were created by the elites and simply imposed upon the poor. No, 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 no. We all want to be superior in some degree or other. Well, if we want to be superior and we rank ourselves compared to others, some will do well and some will do poorly. In other words, something like poverty isn't an absolute, it's relative. People in poverty in our society are hurting not because they're physically hurting. They've got enough food. They've got two-thirds of automobiles, for heaven's sakes. No, they're hurting because they're comparing themselves with the rich people above them who have very much more. But this business of some having more and some having less, that's built into our social nature. And any effort to try to eliminate that is a fantasy that's probably going to make things worse in some ways. So there are constraints that conservatives try to understand when they try to introduce improvements. They don't think, oh, just because we can imagine it, we can make it come true.
How about conservative versus neoconservative versus religious conservative? Could you break those down?
Oh, yes. We have many different kinds of conservatives, okay? A lot of people, a lot of liberals tend to think of all conservatives as liberal religious conservatives, as wanting to simply go back and do what the Bible says, fundamentalists, largely Protestant fundamentalists. I'm not that kind of conservative myself. I am, in fact, very, very secular. And I respect religion and I respect people's beliefs, but I don't share them. Then you have the traditional conservatives who have a great deal of respect for the past and assume that the lessons learned in the past are often going to be superior to the lessons learned today. Myself, while I respect tradition in the sense that I don't believe our ancestors were dummies, I think they did learn a thing or two, and we can learn from them, I also think we have to build upon what they gave us. And in that sense, I'm a neoconservative, or maybe even a neo-neoconservative. I say, gee whiz, let us be fiscally sound, let us understand the limitations of the world, but let us strive to actually make improvements. Not great, fanciful improvements, but step-by-step improvements that are real. I believe in what I call realistic idealism rather than romantic idealism.
In your view, Professor, who was the greatest U.S. president?
Oh, gosh.
And why?
Oh, I think the two greatest, without a doubt, are Washington and Lincoln, for different reasons. If Washington was not the man he was, we might have had a monarchy. He was a reasonable man, a man of modesty, who was able to step back and allow the country to develop as a democracy. We owe him a great deal for that service. Lincoln was a man of responsibility. The man did what needed to be done in the midst of extremely harsh conditions. He helped bring about the end of slavery, which was an unconditional good thing. Okay, and he did it in circumstances that most people would have found impossible. So, yeah, those are the two most important presidents, easily.
We have an emailer, Ginger, in Miami, would like to point out that the poor of today are better off than the poor of the past, as you mentioned earlier, because of the liberally instituted social safety nets, Social Security, food stamps, and welfare aid to families. The Republican Party of Lincoln and the conservative Republicans today are the same in name only.
Yeah. Well, she couldn't be more wrong. Once upon a time, I worked in welfare in New York City. I went to the homes of poor people. I saw what welfare did to people. I saw how it sapped them of their energies and led to a life of misery. Instead of encouraging people to be independent and personally responsible and do all that they can do, they were being encouraged to let the government take care of them as if they were children who didn't have the ability to do for themselves. This is not a benefit to anyone. And if liberals think it is, it's because they haven't seen it personally. I find that an awful lot of liberals are limousine liberals. They live comfortable lives themselves, and they don't understand what their policies are actually doing on the ground. They assume that because they have good intentions, and I do believe they have good intentions, that it's all going to work out in the end. They don't get there down into the nitty-gritty and see how it's actually hurt people.
Let's take a few listener calls. We're speaking with Professor Melvin Fine. We're talking about his book, The Death of a Dream, Countless Promises That Liberalism Has Made and Why None of Them Have Come True. First up, we have Mark. He's in Davie. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, I just want to say thanks, Professor, for having the courage to express these views because they're pretty unpopular right now, but I believe them. And I have a question about, don't you think that after so many people become dependent on the government more so than ever before, now we're all the way down this slope of socialism, and because those people can vote, they're not going to vote any other way, and we're going to go into socialism in this country.
I understand your concerns, and I share them, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think we've seen more than once the American people get to a point where they're at the brink, and then they realize, wait a minute now, this isn't what we thought, and people are going to pull back. I think Americans still have initiative. Americans still want to be successful. Actually, I believe this of many people who are deeply involved in liberalism. As I say, I believe, see, there are some liberals who are going to be true believers no matter what. But many liberals are not that far gone, if I can put it that way. They are going to be able to step back, and they are going to say, wait a minute now. Gee, liberalism didn't deliver on education. Gee, liberalism didn't bring about peace. Gee, liberalism didn't get rid of poverty. Gee, liberalism didn't clean up the environment. Gee, liberalism made us poorer. And they're going to go, wait a minute now. Is this what we want? And people are going to look at what socialism did. They're going to look at Russia. They're going to look at China. They're going to look at Eastern Europe. They're going to look at Cuba. They're going to look at Tanzania. They're going to look at all of the failed experiments in socialism. And some people, who I hope are reasonably well-educated, are going to say, wait a minute now, that's not what we want. We want justice. We want fairness. We want decency. But we don't want what they brought. We don't want totalitarianism. We don't want the government so strong that the people can't resist it. We want the government to help the people. We don't want to eliminate the government, but we want the government to be within bounds. We want a balance between the government and the private sector, just like we want a balance between the different sectors of the government. That's what's going to protect us, not one side winning completely over the other. That's dangerous.
Professor, how about your view of libertarianism?
I am not a libertarian. Absolutely not. They see, like some folks, like the Marxists, I see the libertarians as ideologues. They have a theory. They have a theory that they believe is going to work with mathematical precision. I don't believe in such ideologies. I believe in, let's look at the world. Let's learn from the world. Let's be pragmatic. Let's understand all of the complexities. Ideology simplifies things. It makes it easier. It gives you the answers to everything. I don't believe in that. I believe that that's why I'm a sociologist. I'm out trying to learn more and more about how the world actually works, not merely how people want it to work.
Ken in Miami writes, that you say that if there's a high income tax rate on investments, no one will invest. It's been shown historically to not be true. In 1960, the income tax rate on the highest bracket was 91%. Warren Buffett was making his first few million right around this time off of his investing. Buffett himself said tax rates didn't prevent him from investing either. He said even with the 91% income tax, he'd still be 9% ahead of where we started, so there wouldn't be any reason not to invest.
Oh, really?
In this time period, there was no financial crisis. Those didn't begin to happen until the 80s when Reagan started cutting capital gains taxes and income taxes to the lowest they've ever been.
I guess this guy never heard of Jack Kennedy. I guess he never heard of the tax cuts under the Kennedy administration. I guess he never heard of how the economy surged when the government did that. I guess he never heard about how Kennedy was talking about how the economy had slowed down toward the end of the Eisenhower administration. You know, this selective cherry-picking of data and picking an authority, Warren Buffett, the great man who knows everything because he's rich, this is silly and short-sighted and anti-intellectual. It pretends, gee whiz, here's knowledge, when it is so selective that it distorts reality. It's shameful.
Hmm. We're speaking with sociology professor Melvin Fine. He's written Post-Liberalism, The Death of a Dream, Countless Promises That Liberalism Has Made, Why None of Them Have Come True. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take another short break, and we'll come back, take more of your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you along with Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with Professor Melvin Fine of Kennesaw State University. He's a sociologist, and he's the author of Post-Liberalism, The Death of a Dream. Back to some of our calls. We have many. Warren in Delray Beach. Hi.
Hi, Joseph, Bonnie, and Richard. Thank you very much for allowing me to participate today. Normally, I would say to you merely that you're enormously tolerant for allowing someone as low as myself.
Let's get to a question or a comment.
I have a comment, certainly, but the fascism is so thick today, I could break a jackhammer on it. Liberalism, first of all, I get very annoyed when I hear these types of people talk about the liberals, with the tone of voice that Hitler would have used to describe Jews, okay? The function of government, the word govern means to control. This gentleman, Professor Fine, has trouble with people like Roosevelt, who instituted a necessary institution like Social Security, because people like Professor Fine can do the arithmetic and have it figured out how to take it away from the worker faster than he or she can make it, so that there's nothing left in their old age. Last night, Senator Bernie Sanders was on with Tavis Smiley talking about how government, basically both sides, have been bought by the corporations, by the big concerns and so forth. Things like medical care are a human right, and how are people going to get jobs in corporations when they're insisting on these online applications?
Okay, Warren, let the guest respond, if you
will. Well, let me just please, okay. Let me conclude by saying that I campaign against these things several times a week, including up in Washington, and I may not be able to change those characters who are doing this, but I can make sure every time I make a phone call like this that they don't change me.
Thank you, Warren.
Yeah, okay, can I respond?
Sure.
Please.
Okay, well, this gentleman is a example of the true believer liberal, who believes in name-calling. He thinks that if he calls me enough names and he casts aspersions on my beliefs and my desires, that therefore he is going to prove me wrong and that he is a much better person than I. This is a person who doesn't understand that Nazi is a contraction for National Socialist. He probably thinks that Nazism was a conservative movement. It was a socialist movement that believed in control from the central government. To equate what I believe with the Nazis is absolutely absurd. It's name-calling, nothing less than that. And to assume that the benefits that people have achieved in this country have come from the government is simply a lack of knowledge about history. This man has indicated that basically he does believe in socialism. That's what Sanders is, isn't he? For heaven's sakes. Okay? No. This country did not get rich because the government created bureaucracies a la the Soviet Union. It got rich because of the free market, and it got so rich that everybody, including the poor, could partake of these riches. In other words, these folks want to kill the golden goose because they have this silly, ignorant, and I'm using name-calling now, I apologize for that, but a belief system that is not based upon knowledge. And shame on him for thinking that he is superior and he is going to go and save us by telling the folks in government that we should do what he believes is necessary. He is wrong. He doesn't know it, but he is wrong and dangerous to the country as a whole.
Let's take some more calls, Professor, if you would. This is Marilyn. She's in Delray. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say thank you. I, too, share a lot of the views that I hear the professor speak about, and it's made me curious enough to want to go buy the book. I love, in general, this program. It seems that, you know, really diverse views without speaking over or on top of one another, so that's a very nice change from some other programs that we've all heard. But my comment is, when I was younger, I think I was more liberal, and I think as you get older, you get a little more skin in the game. I run my own business, and your views start to naturally change. And I'm always just fascinated how sometimes I hear views from people that I would expect to be college age, and, you know, they're far more advanced than that, so, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, beyond. And I'm just always fascinated by that. And I think whether you own a mortgage, you own property, you own a business, you start, you know, taking ownership and responsibility and accountability for yourself. And I think it seems to be lacking. So I'm very, very glad to hear some different views posted here today. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. Any comments, thank Professor?
You. Well, now, I agree with the woman. I started out as a socialist. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, and everyone around me was a socialist or a liberal. I understand the good intentions of people, and I sympathize with the good intentions. Heck, my brother, who's one of the best people I know, is very strongly liberal. But yes, I think that the more you live in this world, the more you make unwelcome discoveries. The dreams we have as children, as young people, are glowing, and it would be nice if they could come true. There are many things in this world that are not nice. As even Jimmy Carter said, the world is not fair. It isn't fair. What you do is you try to strive to make it better. You don't strive to make it perfect. In other words, when you try to make it perfect, as Adolf Hitler did, and understand his view of perfection was, the German people are in charge. When you do that, terrible things happen. And so I say, let's be careful, let's be restrained, let us investigate what we do before we jump in and do it.
I wanted to ask you, Professor, what you meant when you said that liberals such as President Obama have disrespected the complaints of ordinary voters. Isn't it just the opposite?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. Look, the president won a victory. Got to give him credit for that. He did win, but he didn't win an overwhelming victory. What, 51-some-odd percent? And a lower number voted for him this time than did 4 years ago. No, there are an awful lot of people who are unhappy. I've just recently started a nonprofit foundation called Morality Now! Exclamation point. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been talking to, that's dedicated to promoting 5 core values that I believe liberals and conservatives can all agree on. And these 5 values are honesty, responsibility, fairness in the sense of the same rules for everybody, family, and liberty. And I discovered that in talking to people, not just conservatives, but liberals are hungry for these things too. They too are deeply upset by the dishonesty represented by Obama. They couldn't bring themselves to vote for Romney for a variety of reasons, but their love for Obama is much decreased.
What do you mean dishonesty?
Oh, didn't the president say, he has lied about so many things, it's just absurd. Didn't he say, he said that he's going to meet the Republicans halfway. He's never done anything remotely like that.
I think he tried, didn't he?
Never. When? Tell me when. When did he do that? When he came in office, he said to them, I'm going to meet you halfway. And then he went to them and said, we're going to do it my way, not your way. And he incorporated none of their ideas. Please. This is a man who said, gee, we want a balanced approach. We want to have one-quarter taxes and three-quarters cuts in spending. Gets in, it's going to be three-quarters taxes increases and one-quarter spending, only there's no cuts in spending. Please, this is not truth. This is deception. This is distortion. This is misrepresentation. This is trying to fool people through honeyed words. Gee, I'm a great speaker. If you don't listen to what I say carefully, if you just listen to my tone of voice, you'll think I'm a great man. You listen to what he says, he contradicts himself all the time.
Let's go back to our callers, Professor, if you will. This is Don. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi, Joe. Thank you. I agree with Professor Fine in believing in balance between government and individual enterprise, but I don't hear it in his positions. Total dependency on government is unbalanced. Total dependency on individual enterprise is unbalanced. For example, public education is a collective government activity necessary to level the playing field of life, to better provide everyone with a chance to be all they can be. at the end of World War II, when we were in great debt, government invested in the GI Bill to provide education and housing to veterans, and in the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. Those collective investments paid off by growing the largest middle class in human history. President Obama wants government to make investments that pay off in the long run, not waste investments on short-term corporate quarterly report gains. And so I just see a distortion in his positions relative to what he claims are his beliefs.
Professor?
Well, now, we agree on balance. We seem to have a different idea about what balance is. Obama has increased the percentage of the GDP that's being funneled into the government dramatically. You know, went from 18% up to almost 25%. Much, much more government than we have historically had. He's clearly tilting the balance, bringing in health care under the rubric, one-sixth of the economy under the rubric of the government. This is a balance going all one way. This is not the kind of balance that we have had. Mind you, I'm an educator. I'm an educator who works for a state school, Kennesaw State University. Okay, I'm not against the government being involved in education, but you know, we have doubled and tripled the amount of money we have spent on education, and what has been the payoff? Very, very little. In fact, no improvement in the outcomes that we've had. No, it comes to a point where the government's getting more involved doesn't give you the benefits that we did, in fact, get from the GI Bill. No, you get to the point where you need things coming from ordinary people. One of the things you discover as an educator is that the students who benefit from the classroom are the folks who are already motivated to benefit from it. That's what we need to encourage. We as a civil society, not a government, as a civil society, need to encourage the moral principles of which I spoke a little while ago.
We're speaking with Professor Melvin Fine. He's written Post-Liberalism, Death of a Dream. It's Topical Currents. One more short break, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Professor Melvin Fine. And we go back to our listener calls. This is Tony. He's in Miami. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. It would be nice if the professor would come out straight and tell the public which political slant he's in. And just by noticing his voice on public radio, I'm assuming that the professor is against liberalism. In that case, he's going to turn in his Medicare and Social Security card and say, you know what, I don't really deserve it, I don't really believe in it, so it's a disservice for the professor not to warn the listener where he's coming from. I disagree with many of the topics and the issues he has raised. I am a product of public school, both high school as well as university, and I'm looking forward for Medicare in my retirement. I don't look forward towards some corporation saying, you know what, you haven't paid your light bill, we're going to take it off. This is a market guy. I apologize, Professor, but you just have no one on the radio to challenge your views. Thank you.
Okay, Professor.
Well, I thought I'd made my beliefs abundantly clear. I'm not hiding my light under a bushel, for heaven's sakes. And the gentleman said, gee, you should turn in your Social Security and whatnot. He sounds like some of those conservatives who say to liberal critics, well, you should leave the country if you're not happy with it. This is silly. If I believe that some things need to be fixed in this country, and I believe that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid need to be fixed, not eliminated, but fixed. That doesn't mean that, gee whiz, I should not be allowed to benefit from the things of this country. This is some more name calling. This is some more let me beat you over the head because I disagree with you kind of thinking. That's not right. That's not fair.
I don't think he called you a name.
Well, he said that, no, he did not literally call me a name, but he said essentially, you should, if you're an honest person, you should no longer participate in the benefits of this country. That is what he literally said. In other words, he was calling me selfish. He was calling me dishonest. He was saying that I was a hypocrite. Okay? He didn't use those words, but that was certainly the implication of what he said.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask you, before we go, we're getting close to the end of the program. If we look at the fact that marijuana was just legalized in two states, gay marriage now legal in many states,
yeah,
passage of the Affordable Health Care Act, gays permitted to serve in the military, pending immigration reform, among many other things, wouldn't it seem that liberalism is alive and well?
Some of these drifts have been happening irrespective of liberalism. You know, attitudes towards blacks have changed before liberalism pushed it. Attitudes towards homosexuals have been gradually evolving. I don't think you can attribute those to liberalism. Immigration, same thing. Certainly some of the things that have happened because of liberalism, for example, I think that this business of putting women in combat in the military is very, very dangerous. Militaries need cohesion between men. It's not an individual thing about individual rights. It's about groups of men working together cohesively to protect the nation. In other words, you have to start thinking about all of our good rather than the good of particular interest groups.
Professor, so, you seem to be very sensitive to this name-calling business, but yet in your book, you compare today's, quote, liberals with flying saucer cults.
I do, because because it's very much the same thing. It's sort of like it's absolutely remarkable. Every time a liberal idea fails, they never admit that it fails, and they simply move on and reinterpret things. Education didn't improve with progressive education. Well, gee, we just need to throw more money at it. Crime rates did not go down by changing the rules with which you dealt with criminals. Well, gee whiz, we need to get rid of the oppressive regime that we have. On and on it goes. Gee, you know, it wasn't the liberals who ended the Cold War. Well, no, then, Reagan had nothing to do with it. No. This business of denying the reality in order to hold on to the ideology is absolutely a fact of liberalism. And yes, I used the dramatic example because I wanted to show people the roots of why this happens. Help people understand that people whom I do believe, many of whom, are honest and well-meaning, if they can understand what they are in the midst of doing, they may, if not get a change their ideas, at least perhaps modify them a little bit.
We have another emailer. We have so many. Unfortunately, we can't get to all of them or our calls. But
we're very short on time.
Yeah, Michael says he would suggest the truth is always in the middle. Government, just like corporations, has advantages and disadvantages, corruption, bureaucracy, and waste are present in large corporations, as they are in government. Welfare certainly abused by some, and for those, it is an excuse to avoid action and self-improvement. But for many, it's a safety net to overcome unexpected circumstances. For those that simply don't have the resources to build a great safety net of their own, such as the many that work for minimum wage.
We only have about 30 seconds or so, Professor.
Well, I do believe in safety nets. It's a question of how big a net you're going to have. And that's, remember, I'm not a libertarian. I'm not a far-right conservative. I don't want to get rid of government, but I don't want to keep on increasing it to the point where it suffocates us. And that's the direction in which we are going.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with Kennesaw State University sociology professor Melvin Fine. He's the author of Post-Liberalism, The Death of a Dream, Countless Promises That Liberalism Has Made, and Why None of Them Have Come True. He's been joining us from Canton, Georgia. He's a professor of sociology at Kennesaw State University.
And do you have a website for the book, are you?
Well, MelvinLFine.com, Melvin spelled with a Y and Fine, F-E-I-N, MELVYNLFEIN. And I've also got this new website called moralitynow.net, N-E-T, not com, but net.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And that wraps up today's edition. We apologize to the callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, that's WLRN.org, and much more information at the Topical Currents webpage, Topical Currents Facebook page. Simple enough. Tomorrow's program deals with South Miami-Dade's Turkey Point nuclear plant and FPL's plan for expansion. How will rising sea levels affect such a project? The groundwork has been approved by the County Commission. And to our calendar, on this day in 1914, 99 years ago, the birth of writer William Burroughs in St. Louis, the author of Naked Lunch. He was of the Burroughs Adding Machine family and a founder of the Beat Generation. Also, happy birthday to Barry University in Miami Shores. On this day in 1940, 73 years ago, the school was incorporated as Barry College, became a university in 1981. One more while we remember the patented Sky Hook. On this day in 1989, 34 years ago, L.A. Lakers center Kareem Abdul-Jabbar becomes the first NBA player to score 38,000 points. His teams won 6 pro championships, including one with the Bucks. Today's book link at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And we leave with a thought from William Burroughs, who coined the musical term heavy metal. I certainly didn't know that. Quote from Burroughs, "In the U.S., you have to be a deviant or exist in extreme boredom. Make no mistake, all intellectuals are deviants in the U.S. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.